Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg is a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association with a private practice in Manhattan. He's got a specialty in addiction. He's also a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the Cornell Medical Center. His new book is Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. It will also air as a documentary on Independent Lens on PBS in April of next year, and we will definitely have Dr. Rosenberg back to talk about his documentary. And Dr. Rosenberg goes by Ken. Hi, Ken. Thank you so much for joining us and writing this very important book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, in the book, you said that when you first started writing it and working on it, you did not want to include your own story, but you eventually realized that you had to. Can you talk about that process? How did you realize that you had to include your personal story?
Well, great question. So initially, I thought I'd make a film in a week or two about patients in a psych ER in Los Angeles. I quickly realized that that wasn't the film I was going to make because I really didn't get a feel for who these people were. They were just kind of like somewhat objectified. And I really felt to make the film, I needed to not make a film, about people, but really with those people. So I wanted to know them. I wanted to follow them. I wanted to be with their families. I wanted to follow their stories for years and years and years. And then I realized, in putting the film together, actually in editing it, at some point I literally went to a barn in Martha's Vineyard where I tend to hang out in the summers, and I took my editing equipment with me and decided, I really need to put myself in it because the film's fine, but you really don't understand what the motivation is behind it. Why did this person, myself, the filmmaker and author of the book, why this person go to all this trouble to explore this? What brings this story to this person, and why the heck did they do it? And I decided that I would experiment in this barn in the summer with no one around, no editors, no fellow filmmakers, just to see what it would be like if I started telling my own story. And I realized then that the film and the project and the book started to make sense. I also realized that it was therapeutic for me, that it was something I kind of needed to do. For most of my life, I told not a soul about my sister. My wife knew about it only after, a couple of years of knowing me. And it's something I really kept a secret from everyone. When I went into my psychiatric residency, the first day I landed there, a very wonderful psychiatrist, a fellow resident, walked into the room, and she said, we have something in common. We both have siblings with schizophrenia, to which I turned white. I couldn't believe that this secret that I had shared during the interview, which I rarely shared, was shared with her. And that was the last conversation she and I had till about 3 years ago when I put her in my book. Because she now is a distinguished professor of psychiatry, one of the foremost leaders in schizophrenia research and practice, and really essentially runs the program for New York State for those with schizophrenia. And I thought, what better use of her than to say, hi, remember me? I remember that horrible conversation in which I kind of blocked you out of my life. Well, now it's time to bring you back into my life. That was part of the process, and I think that's part of the process for all of us. Mm. We say throughout the book, throughout the film, you can't fix something you can't face. That's true for America. That's true for me.
It was so interesting to learn that you never told anyone about your sister, not even your best friends. And the book, in many ways, is also about stigma. And did you not tell anyone around you, your friends, even your professional associates, because of stigma?
Absolutely. I think things have changed mm-hmm. since, but not so much. But at that time, I felt that people would judge me and think that I was, somehow mentally ill, and that was a terrible thing to be. I think now, I know differently. But even in psychiatry, even being a psychiatrist, there were psychiatric residents in my training in the 1980s who were willing to talk about their siblings. I was not one of them. We would be in groups in which people would say, it's very hard for me to be on the wards because it reminds me of my sister and my brother. I said, not a word. And I think that I carried that shame. Even though I became a psychiatrist to help people like my sister, I also just carry so much stigma and didn't want to tell anyone about it. And in some ways, you know, writing this book, doing this film is my opportunity to do that. But as I say, I think it's a symbolic of what we all need to do. You know, I always get the question after I do a book reading or show the film, what, Dr. Rosenberg, should we do about this? And I have many ideas, and we could talk about them. Many social policy changes which need to be enacted. But the first thing we need to do is to have a conversation, because until we change it, until we talk about it, rather, we can't change it. And I, like many people, refuse to talk about it. And most people, you know, who go into this field have some personal reason. As you know from the book, as you'll see in the film, a lot of the people who I interview, the psychiatrists, the leaders in the field, are there only because they have family members with a similar disease. But few people talk about it.
You spent some, as you said, you spent so much time getting to know patients, and they decided to share stories and their families to prevent the suffering of others and to let people know that you're not alone.
Correct.
And that is so important. It's even today, it's so important.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the mottos of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, to say you are not alone. You know, this is a very, very common problem. One in four, maybe one in five families have someone with a mental illness. 50% of us need psychiatric care at some point in our lives. That shouldn't be a surprise, because we need medical care throughout our lives. Why should we not need psychological and psychiatric care? 20% of us will deal with a very disabling a problem, such as serious addiction or serious anxiety and depression. And 1 to 2 to 3% of us will deal with psychosis. This is not unusual, and it affects, you know, millions upon millions of people, destroys their lives, and as a consequence of our secrecy, we have not only suffered in silence, but we've kind of allowed the pharmaceutical companies and the people who put us in jail and criminalized mental illness to kind of, you know, do what they want with us, because we're kind of dependent on the kindness of strangers when we don't talk, speak up for ourselves.
I think we should repeat this number, Ken, because this is just really incredible. 1 in 5 adults lives with a mental illness in the United States. 1 in 5. And then in your book, you also write that less than half of American adults with psychiatric disorders receive mental health care. For people with serious conditions, that number is a whopping 66%.
Oh, yes. Worldwide, it's 70%. Wow. 70% of people worldwide who have psychiatric illnesses, particularly serious psychiatric illnesses, never see treatment, never get any kind of treatment. Now, the treatments are very imperfect. They're very problematic. They have side effects. They need to be much more advanced. But they are also life-saving. And the fact that people don't get treatment is criminal. You know, we've criminalized mental illness by putting people with mental illness in jails. But we've also acted in a way that I think is a crime in terms of, really not giving them proper treatment. And there's many reasons for that, but the major reason is stigma.
Mm. And this is really turning into a crisis. It'll be an even bigger crisis because, according to a 2018 Lancet Commission report, mental illness is on the rise in every country in the world.
Yes, according to that commission report, mental illness will soon exceed, in terms of its cost burden, the burden in terms of mortality, morbidity, financial costs. Mental illness will soon exceed the cost burden of all non-communicable diseases, including cardiac disease and cancers. Mental illness is a greater problem than all those diseases combined. However, if you look at the funding, we spend $6 billion on cancer research through the NIMH. Mm-hmm. We spend $1 billion on cardiac research. We spend $462 million on serious mental illness. There's quite a disparity, right? So it is a bigger problem. You just said a moment ago, it's going to become a crisis. No.
It is a crisis.
With all due respect, I think it is the crisis of the day.
Yeah.
And the environment is certainly a crisis. We have political crises, regrettably. But I would say one of the, if not the greatest social crisis of our time, is the way we deal with
serious mental illness. We put these people in jails. We let them languish and die on the streets. We have treatments that are antiquated. To me, that's one of the greatest, if not the greatest, social crisis of our time.
You know, I was really shocked when I read about the funding, the lack of funding on research for mental illness. You interviewed the director of the NIMH. Can you tell us what that is? National Institute for Mental Health?
Yeah, National Institute for Mental Health, Joshua Gordon, very right. smart guy, who laments the fact that we don't have more money. He also laments the fact that we don't have more candidate molecules to discover. So, you know, the pharmaceutical companies, if they had a candidate molecule, they would go to town on it. I mean, there's a lot of money to be made in treating people with schizophrenia. That's not why we should do it, but pharmaceutical companies have a responsibility to their stakeholders. But they don't really have something that promising. So essentially now, pharmaceutical companies have all but pulled out of neuropsych research. In fact, a friend of mine, Fuller Torrey, did a study and looked at the new medication trials into new medication treatments in the past 15 years. And despite the fact that we're in the midst of this crisis, medication trials have decreased by 90%.
Wow.
Decreased by 90%. So things are going from bad to worse to dismal.
Since you brought up meds, let's talk about them for a minute. Because, you know, we do so many shows about health issues, and people say that sometimes they're not feeling well or they feel a little depressed, but it's not severe. And they go to a doctor, and inevitably they say you should take antidepressants. And as you say, on balance, these medications save lives and are essential for people to get better, but they're also very problematic because of side effects, for example. In many ways, I mean, I'm helping a loved one right now, and the doctors have been really honest. They said, look, you know, put her on this medication for 3 months and see what happens, and if she doesn't like it, come back and we'll try something different.
Right. That's no way to deal with a life-threatening illness, right? We should be further advanced. You have cancer, God forbid. You have a protocol, and it's a universal protocol. And by the way, it's a protocol that's probably been modified sometime in the past 5 or even 3 years. You have a medicine, if you have cancer, God forbid, that's been developed in the past 3 or 5 years. That's not what happens with psychiatric illness. You have medicines that are 70 years old. Maybe some newer medicines, you know, we call them in the book Me Too medicines, because they're medicines that are not a whole lot different from the ones that were developed 70 years ago. And you don't, and patients often feel, I understandably, like guinea pigs. Like, you're just going to try me on one, you know, you have 10 classes of drugs, you're going to try me on one, and then the other, and then maybe all 10 combined. That's not where we should be at. However, having said all that, that's no reason not to take the meds, because you're in far worse shape if you don't take the meds. And by the way, far worse shape if you don't get psychotherapy. I'm a big believer in psychotherapy, psychosocial treatments, exercise. I ask all my patients, if they can, to eat right, to meditate, to do all those things that we know make you feel better without side effects. So treatment is essential, but it's not where it should be, to say the least.
So as you point out, today's antipsychotic and bipolar medications are much safer, they're more tolerable, and they have fewer side effects than the drugs that people took in the 1950s and the 60s, but they are no more effective in eradicating symptoms.
I mean, that's exactly right.
That's amazing
that's exactly
to me.
Right. You know, it's a complicated thing to talk about. Let's break it down a little bit. Because if people have fewer side effects, if the drugs are safer, if they're easier to give out, that was a big advance of Prozac, that, you know, you didn't have to be a genius to give it out. You didn't have to wait for a while. You didn't have to titrate the dose. It wasn't going to kill the patient. The big advance was it was very, very easy to give. But it wasn't that much more effective than the prior antidepressants. But when we're talking about psychosis, you don't have anything that's more effective. The gold standard for psychosis was Thorazine in the 1950s. A new gold standard developed in really the late 1950s and popularized in the 1980s is a drug called clozapine. That was, you know, somewhat revolutionary, but for a lot of reasons that never caught on. It has a side effect called agranulocytosis that decreases your white cell count. Psychiatrists are skittish to give that. And it's a problematic drug, causes lots of weight gain. So we really haven't made the advances that we need to make. We just haven't.
And we're no closer to a cure.
We're unfortunately no closer to a cure. Now, I will hasten to add, if we didn't have a single new drug, if we didn't have a single new treatment, we could save millions of lives. Because as we said at the top of this, 50% of people don't get any treatment. Worldwide, 70% of people don't get any treatment. So some treatments better than no treatment. But we are no closer to a cure. No. We have a better understanding. There are some good leads. We have some interesting theories about what causes schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, and we could get into that. But that has not yet translated into something you can give a loved one and will change the course or cure and eradicate their illness.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg, author of the new book, very important book, Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. Dr. Rosenberg, since we're talking about meds and other things that you can do, like you said, definitely some kind of therapy, in the back of your book, and I really appreciate you doing this, I really wish I had your book about a year and a half ago, because this system is very difficult to navigate. Even if, like me, you're a really good researcher, I had a heck of a time even learning the difference between psychiatrist, psychologist, therapist, who takes Medicare, who doesn't. You know, where do you even begin? It's just, there are great organizations out there, but it's still really difficult to navigate. You have to call doctors and therapists. And I mean, I probably made more than 150 phone calls while I'm on my way to work, while I'm on my way home, I'm on the phone. It's so difficult. So where should people begin if they feel like they might have depression or some kind of mental illness, or if someone they love might have a mental illness? I could not figure out where to begin.
Yes. You know, we're going to say it over and over again. They should begin to have a conversation. They should begin to talk freely about this. They, you know, I'm Jewish, and in my parents' way of thinking about it, they spoke Yiddish. Mental illness was a shanda, a shame, something that was a secret to be kept. And in many communities, Jewish, non-Jewish, all religions, it still is quite a secret to be kept. So the first step is, you know, this is not such a secret. Everyone has it in their family. Many people have it in their own lives. It's not such a secret. So you have to really begin to talk about it. And thank goodness we are talking about it more and more. Once you talk about it, then you could not only just go to the internet, you know, in the middle of the night when no one's looking, but you could talk to your friends. You could talk to your doctor. It's shocking how seldom people talk to their doctors about their mental illness. I'm a psychiatrist. I'm an addiction psychiatrist. I specialize in addiction. It's very common when I see a patient that they have not told anyone about their addiction, and their own doctor, their internist, their family practitioner has no idea that you know, they have an addiction. So first and foremost, can't say it enough, have a conversation and realize that, as we said earlier, you're not alone in this. This is actually more common than cancer, cardiac disease, and all non-communicable diseases combined. There's nothing so special about this. And what is the tragedy is when you can't talk about it. Then, who do you talk to? Well, you talk to your doctor, for starters. And you find a doctor you could trust, because unfortunately, not all doctors are informed. Some have stigmas and shame of their own. Some, you know, say, oh, this is nothing to worry about, even if it is something to worry about. And, of course, being a psychiatrist, I'm a very big fan of speaking to a psychiatrist, a qualified psychiatrist, someone you could trust, someone who, you know, you could take her or his advice and really run with it. So You know, those are the steps. There are also fantastic community organizations you can rely on. One of the best. I can't say the best because there are many out there, but they're my dear friends, and I think they do an incredible job, is NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. They have chapters in nearly every city. They have incredible information online. And through NAMI, you can start to really learn more about the serious mental illnesses. There's other organizations that could educate you, something called the Treatment Advocacy Center, many, many organizations. Once you sort of, you know, talk about it, and once you talk about it with your friends, you'll find if they are willing to share the secret, they will tell you, oh, here's what I did. I saw this doctor, I saw this nurse, I saw this therapist, and they worked wonders. The other thing I talk about in the back of the book in terms of practical advice is you need to be open. You know, there are treatments that you may be prejudiced against, you may be against psychotherapy, you may be against medication, you may be against shock therapy, which I know sounds terrible, but it's really quite effective and quite safe nowadays. I know it's a very unpopular thing to talk about, but truth be told, it's among the safer treatments out there. And I think, and you need to be open to what the possibilities are, because, you know, if you have a house on fire, to give you an analogy, and you don't call the fire department till the house is almost burned down, you're going to salvage less of the house than if you call them early on. If your brain is on fire with psychosis or serious depression or any kind of serious mental illness, and you don't call for help until you are living in the streets and in and out of jails, more damage is likely, not, you know, definitely, but likely to be done to the brain. Just like if you have a broken ankle and you run on it every day and don't get help, you're going to have a far worse problem with your ankle than if you go to the emergency immediately. Well, most of us, when we have a pain or in our ankle or we think we might break something, we go to the emergency room immediately. We see the best doctor we can see. We ask her or him for some advice. But with mental illness, we don't go off until it's very, very late in the game, until damage is done, maybe to the brain, but certainly to our lives and our relationships.
We're going to take a quick break. Today we're speaking with Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg, author of the new book, Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we're talking about the mental health crisis in this country and around the globe with Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg, a fellow of the American Psychiatric Association with a private practice in Manhattan, where he specializes in addiction. Dr. Rosenberg is also a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the Cornell Medical Center. His new book is Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. It will air as a documentary on Independent Lens on PBS next April, and we will definitely have Ken back when that documentary comes out. Ken, before the break, we were talking about steps that people can take. And again, just to repeat these staggering statistics, 1 in 5 adults lives with a mental illness in the United States, according to the National Institute of Mental Health. And of that total, just over 11 million people age 18 or older have a serious mental illness. Now, so many people, especially if you have a loved one with a mental illness, you just rack your brain saying, what happened to this person? Was it the culture? Was it something in their childhood? Was it because their granddaughter left the state? What happened? And so in your book, you ask, you know, in general, why do people develop mental illness? And you write, whether it's genes, environment, upbringing, or disease, the question has intrigued and perplexed scientists and philosophers alike. The truth is, we don't know. But it's increasingly apparent that there is an interplay of influences in every case, not just a single trigger. So I really appreciated this section because you've got poverty and trauma, substance abuse, nature and nurture. How do you answer that question?
Well, I think just the way you did, and I think you restated it very eloquently, thank you. Mental illness is really impossible to understand, and my sister's mental illness is still incomprehensible to me. You know, how she deteriorated, how she threw herself out of a window in the throes of psychosis, it's incomprehensible. And how it develops and why it develops is nearly impossible to understand. But we know a couple of facts. If you have an identical twin with the same exact DNA who has schizophrenia, you have about a 50% chance, 50% chance of getting that, which means you have about a 50% chance of not getting it. So it's not just DNA. It's something that happens after the DNA is created, you know, in the embryo. It could be another genetic mutation. It could be an environmental toxin. It could be something that happens in your life where it just triggers it. Maybe your personality, meeting other personalities, maybe your maybe it's substance abuse. I happen to think substance abuse is a big problem, frankly. I think substance abuse is way underestimated in opening a window on serious mental illness that would otherwise be closed. You know, we talk a lot about providing, you know, allowing, for instance, teens and young adults to smoke marijuana. I am very much for, oh my God, so much for decriminalization. But I'm concerned because the more drugs that that developing brain is exposed to, the more bad things that can happen. So I think substance abuse is certainly an issue. Poverty is an issue. The trauma of poverty. The trauma of having a mental illness leads to more mental illness because the world doesn't treat you very well and you end up in and out of jails, in and out of relationships. You know, it's very, very hard. So I think that there's a vortex that happens in which many factors commingle and bring you to a state of a serious mental illness. But for the most part, you need some kind of biological element because at the end of the day, however this occurs, it is in the final pathway a brain disease and has to be addressed as a brain disease. We could change the brain with psychotherapy. We could change the brain with yoga. Doesn't mean you need medication, but it really is a brain disease that needs to be addressed. And I think that is the unifying fact of people with serious mental illness, that there is something up with their brain that needs to be, you know, needs to be helped in a medical way.
All of the issues you just talked about lead to stress, and we're learning so much more about stress and how it affects the brain and the body. What about stress?
Stress is bad for the body. Stress is bad for the brain. You know, we need a little stress to function, but once you get past a threshold, you are relentlessly releasing cortisol, relentlessly releasing noradrenaline, and that's not good for the brain. It's sort of like any other organ. I mean, it's great to go to the gym and have a workout and have your get your heart rate up. It's not great to have your heart rate up and be stressed 24/7, right? That's not good for the heart. So stress is a real problem and makes things worse. And stress may unleash serious mental illness. But again, I can't emphasize it enough. You know, once you have this kind of problem, you're always looking who to blame. And as I say also in the book, the blame game is just a waste of time. You know, we used to blame the mothers of people with schizophrenia. How criminal was that, right? You have to watch your child go from being a somewhat functioning or fully functioning person to an incapacitated adult. And then what the psychiatrists in the 50s used to do is call those mothers, often the mothers, schizophrenogenic, saying that they cause somehow by their interactions or their miscommunications of schizophrenia. That was certainly not only just a waste of time, but in my view, added incredible insult to outrageous injury. And we still look for people to blame, you know, and we still look for things to blame. We blame the police, we blame the people in the jails, we blame the medications. You know, there's many, many potential villains out there, but I think when all is said and done, this is a disease in which there aren't really villains, but there are just lots of victims. So how and why these things happen is unknown. But I think we have to be very, very thoughtful because we don't want to start looking for, you know, what you did wrong and what this sibling did wrong and what this parent did wrong and what that teacher said wrong. I mean, trauma is bad and stress is bad. But at the end of the day, you often need a biological element to get these serious mental illnesses, and you could rack your brain and become terribly guilty for no good reason to think about why it happened. So, yes, stress is a problem, but I caution to add, it's
time to stop looking for, you know, whose fault it is, and start by having a conversation and finding constructive solutions. And as I say over and over again, our treatments are imperfect. In fact, I think they're dreadful in many respects, but they're the best we have, and they can save lives.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg about his new book, Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. Dr. Rosenberg is fellow of the American Psychiatric Association with a private practice in Manhattan, where he specializes in addiction. Dr. Rosenberg, let's talk about a couple of stories you share in your book. And, you know, we've been talking about your sister throughout the show, but we haven't really gotten that deep into her story. And you open your book talking about your sister and your family, and you got your first glimpse of psychiatric treatment when your sister suffered her first psychotic break at age 20, and you were 14 at the time, and she was treated at Pennsylvania Hospital. When you kind of looked back at that time and decided to write, to include her story in your book, what really stood out for you when you relived those years?
Well, I think I just feel really sad for her, honestly. Mm-hmm. I feel really sad for my family. I think that they pulled her out of the hospital. They could not accept that she had a mental illness. But the doctors had very little to offer. You know, in that room I write about in the book, the doctors were Freudian doctors at the time, looking for the psychosexual causes for my sister's mental illness. And in the consultation room, there's my sister, who's terribly ill, psychotic, and pacing the room at the time. There's my mother, who's completely distraught. There's my father, who had, up to this point, been the bedrock of our family and able to get us out of any jam or into any restaurant. You know, he's a real problem solver. And there they were in this room with the doctor saying, "Tell us, did you guys ever make love with your daughter?" Hearing you're making love, and I understand the doctor meant well, but that was a terrible question, and it doesn't surprise me that my parents were outraged and said, "We had enough. You guys have nothing to offer her. She's not sick. We're going to deny she's sick. We're going to take her home, and everything's going to be better." Well, of course, nothing was further from the truth. But what struck me is the kind of the tragedy for everyone, my sister, my parents, myself, and the doctors as well, who just didn't know what the heck to do. And as a consequence, things went from bad to far, far worse. And of course, it was at that moment that I thought, you know, a 14-year-old could do better than these doctors, to be perfectly frank. And it was that moment I decided, now I know what I wanted to do with my life. I want to become a psychiatrist because I think that, you know, I have a shot to help families like these.
And you were just 14 at the time.
I was just 14 at the time. Wow.
And at that point, your sister really turned into someone unrecognizable?
Yes. Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, these illnesses cause recurrent episodes so that people become psychotic, they become manic. They change dramatically, and then with medicine or with a respite from the illness, they may reconstitute, as we say in medicine. They may come back to some semblance of who they were. But for the most part, my sister was lost to mental illness. Her brain was a prisoner to psychosis, pretty much for the rest of her life.
And sadly, your sister passed away in 2011 when she was just 55.
Yes, she passed away in 2005.
When 2005, I'm sorry.
Years old, yes. And that's not uncommon. People with serious mental illness pass away 15 to 30 years earlier than the rest of the population. Their care is poor. The medicines may have a role in that. They often get diabetes from the medicines. But they often don't get proper medical care. Whatever killed my sister at 55 could have been prevented. You know, the autopsy report said that she died from a heart attack, with the secondary cause being a breast cancer lesion, which went untreated, largely because my sister refused to see doctors. I think what killed my sister was neither cardiac nor cancer. It was really the kind of incomprehensible and stubborn mental illness that did her in.
Mm. I mean, it is incredible to think that people with a serious mental illness died 28 years earlier than the rest of the population, and that's a lot of people. Because, as we said earlier, just over 11 million people age 18 or older have a serious mental illness in the U.S.
Yes, and when we say 11 million, I put in the most conservative number because I didn't want anyone to say you're making this problem worse than it is. I think the actual number is probably three times that, frankly.
Wow.
Yeah. This is not, you know, one of the things that I think we have to accept as a society is that this is not someone else's problem. This is not a problem of the homeless, because our loved ones very quickly devolve into homeless, mentally ill people. It's not someone else's problem. It's our problem.
Right. Today we're speaking with Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg about his new book, Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis. So, Dr. Rosenberg, you decided at the age of 14 to become a psychiatrist. And now I would like to talk about how you became an activist. This is another incredible story. Let's talk about the case of Monty.
Right.
Monty, as you write, in his late teens began acting strangely, and his younger sister Patrice recalls thinking that his wild mood swings and the hours he spent locked in a bathroom sobbing were caused by his smoking crack. Although he was using street drugs to self-medicate, that was only part of the problem. He didn't sleep, for example. He was arrested at age 19. Tell us a little bit more about Monty and those years of his life.
Well, Monty is a large African-American man, and like many people of color, when the police arrest him for being mentally ill, they take him not to a hospital but to a jail. That's unfortunately a terribly common and tragic occurrence. And so he was diagnosed in jail, and like many people with mental illness, well, we should backtrack. A terrible statistic is that if you have a mental illness this moment, you're 10 times more likely to be in a jail than you are to be in a mental hospital or psychiatric hospital. So what happened to Monty is common, but particularly among people of color. And he went in and out of jail, went in and out of prison, largely because of his mental illness, was diagnosed as having serious issues, schizoaffective disorder. And his sister came to his rescue many times and decided early on that she wanted to be his advocate. Now, I said earlier that when I began this project, I thought I'll just spend a couple of weeks in the emergency room, but then I decided, no, I have to spend a couple of years in these people's lives and not only get to know them, but get to know their family members. And his sister was one of the family members I got to know. And when I met her, she said, I'm an activist and I'm trying to, you know, change the world. And I thought, that's good. I'm thrilled to hear it, that you're the kind of person I'm looking for. And I hope something comes of your activism, but who knows? And it turns out she co-founded Black Lives Matter, and her name is Patrice Cullors. And that happened during the second year of filming. And then she did something really remarkable. She helped stop the building of a $3 billion jail for the mentally ill in Los Angeles. So Patrice has been quite an activist and quite an inspiration to me. And I realize, you know, my small piece of activism, if you will, is writing this book, making this film, and writing about myself and my family, as you said earlier. I did not intend to write about my family. I did not intend to go home and film it. Did not intend to talk about Meryl's illness whatsoever. But I felt that it was my duty, as my effort as an activist of sorts, to share my story so that I could make the point that, as I say over and over again, you know, we can't fix something that we can't face. And I felt I needed to face that, too.
Dr. Rosenberg, this was amazing to read, because I knew of Patrice Cullors and her work with Black Lives Matter, but I did not know her backstory. So it's just huge respect to Patrice. And then huge respect to you. I mean, you write that everyone you followed over the course of your quest has taught you a great deal and inspired you, but it's Patrice who really pushed you toward activism. You write, instead of hiding the truth about her family, she has used it as a rallying cry.
Yes, very much so. I mean, she's really been an inspiration and, you know, and now a very good friend as well. We showed the film at Sundance, and we couldn't have been happier to be together. And guess who also was at Sundance with us? Her brother Monty.
Oh, wow.
It was quite special. And whenever we show the film, we always try to have someone from the community there, someone who was in the film, some of the doctors who appear in the film, some of the doctors I write about, because it's really their story. It's not, you know, it's, I guess, I can't say it's not mine, because it is mine in part, but it's also theirs as well.
How is Monty doing today?
He's good. He's good. I mean, thank God he has Patrice and a loving mother, Charisse, who really look after him. And, you know, I mean, life is not easy for him, but he is definitely winning and fighting the good fight.
Patrice also said that only 5% of psychologists in the country are African-American. There are even fewer African-American psychiatrists. And as a consequence, black people are more likely to get care from non-black providers, which leads to miscommunication, inaccurate diagnosis, subpar care. And this has been my experience, taking a loved one to see, 14 therapists. She just did not connect with many of them.
Right.
And a lot of the reason was because of cultural differences.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was a point made by someone who I admire quite a bit and interviewed, Charlene McCrae, who's the first lady of New York City, the mayor's wife, Bill de Blasio's wife. And she has really taken mental illness to be an important part of her platform and contribution to the city, and she is African American, and pointed out that fewer than 5% of the psychiatrists are African American, and it's quite a problem. You know, conversely, that what we're seeing is the people who are really waging the war on behalf of people with serious mental illness often are African American activists, because this is an issue that disproportionately affects people of color, especially the maltreatment, especially the jail part. And that's why Patrice kind of went into it, because, you know, all those people that she's defending, many of them were shot and killed by the police as a consequence of their mental illness. So, you know, that's not something we think about. We think about Black Lives Matter as protecting black men in particular who are shot by the police. Well, that's true, but they're particularly defending black men who have serious mental illness and who have been shot or killed by the police. And thank God her brother has not been shot by the police, but he certainly has been arrested and brought to jail largely because of his mental illness. And she fears one day, you know, for his life. Well, she fears constantly for his life, I should say.
And as you said, that's so connected to the successful campaign to shut down Rikers, which is on Rikers Island in New York City, the main jail complex, where, you know, so many people have a mental illness. I'd love to have you back to talk more about that, because we're almost out of time, but I just want to point one thing out. You know, I was reading your book, and I actually had to put the book down. This might be disturbing for some people, but you got a tour of Rikers Island and by one high-ranking official who drove you around to point out a few landmarks. And after a couple minutes, he pulled over, pointed to a building, and spoke quietly on the condition of anonymity and said, quote, "In this building, we have situations where mentally ill inmates are disciplined by other prisoners. When guards decide noncompliance merits punishment, they would leave the cell doors ajar so that incarcerated people with mental illnesses deemed unruly could be disciplined by their peers." I mean, that's just horrific.
Yeah. You know, the film and the book is called Bedlam, because Bedlam is many things. It's the first asylum, or at least the world's oldest asylum, established in Bethlehem. It was called Bethlehem Royal Hospital, established outside of London about 600 years ago. It also is the word that means chaos and captures really the essence of what we're dealing with. And it really does capture that horrific scene that you just described of letting people beat people with serious mental illness, to try to beat them in submission, to try to beat them into sanity. And we know that that doesn't help. That just kills people.
Well, people have been successful because Rikers will be shut down, what is it, in the next 5 to 10 years? Is that right?
Yeah, but, you know, let's just be realistic here. The problem is we build hospitals, we shut down hospitals, right. We build asylums, we shut them down, we build jails, we shut them down. That's a good thing to do. To shut down Rikers is the right move to make. But the problem really is the illness, and that's why I argue so vehemently for research, because a brick-and-mortar solution is not going to take care of this. What will take care of this is a national conversation, a national priority, changing the laws that make it impossible for people with mental illness to get proper treatment, and providing research that we would do for any other illness. Look how far we've gotten with cancer. Look how far we've gotten with HIV. These are still dreadful diseases. But they are much more manageable than they were 70 years ago. We can't say the same thing about serious mental illness.
And as you point out in the book, the United States has just 2-3% of the psychiatric treatment beds that we had 60 years ago.
Per capita.
And as you know, I mean, everywhere is a crisis, but San Francisco, there's a major crisis here with very few psychiatric beds. We see people in all neighborhoods on the streets with mental illnesses in this very wealthy city.
And that's many things as mental illness, but as you well know, that's also a housing crisis. You know, you see that not only in places where there are a lack of beds, but you see that in which housing is exorbitantly expensive, and people who are, you know, living hand-to-mouth cannot afford housing in San Francisco or Los Angeles, New York. So that's where we see the greatest homeless populations.
Dr. Rosenberg, before we end the show, you've got a couple examples here in your book of things that are actually working. There's some positive things happening in Miami-Dade County and then in Trieste in northern Italy. What would you like to see grow or emulated in this country?
Well, first of all, I would like to see real parity. I mean, we have a Parity Act that was enacted in 2010 in large measure to Patrick Kennedy, who I regard as a mentor and a friend in this. But we still have not seen real parity. So I think that if we could see that kind of parity where people get mental health treatment on par with medical treatment, that would be a real advance. We need more beds, and one of the ways that we stop the beds is something called the IMD exclusion. It's a very complicated idea, but essentially the feds don't pay for hospitals that have more than 16 psych beds. That's not very sensible because we have 1,500 psych beds in the jails. 1,500 in Twin Towers in Los Angeles alone. So we need more than 16 beds in a hospital for psychiatry. We need community mental health centers. They were a failed experiment, but they were a noble effort and can be done in the proper way. And that's what we see in Trieste, Italy. Very compassionate, good community mental health, which keeps people out of hospitals and keeps them well in the community. We do need universal health care for people with serious mental illness. This is not an argument for socialized medicine or, you know, Medicare for all, but this is an argument for having a system in which people can get treatment, which not only treats them for a few hours at great expense in the emergency room, or for that matter in the jails and prisons at great expense, but treats them in a preventative way, because as we've talked about, it's much easier to treat stage one serious mental illness than it is to treat advanced stage four mental illness. So many things I'd like to see, but as I keep on saying over and over again, I'd like to see the conversation, and I'm very grateful that we're having this conversation. This is precisely why I wrote the book, precisely why we have the film on PBS, so that we can have a national conversation, which has been so far lacking. You know, we showed the film in Sundance, and they said, oh, you know, they were so honored to have the film, and we were, of course, beyond the moon to be there. But they said this was the first film that they had shown on serious mental illness.
Wow.
Well, that was really great, but that was also really mind-blowing, because this is
the most common medical problem among the greatest social crises, but it's not something we're talking about, and we're trying to change that.
Dr. Kenneth Paul Rosenberg is fellow of the American Psychiatric Association with a private practice in Manhattan where he specializes in addiction. His new book is Bedlam, An Intimate Journey into America's Mental Health Crisis, and he will be out with a documentary on PBS in April of next year. Dr. Rosenberg, thank you so much for all of your work, and we would love to have you back when your documentary is out.
Love to be there. Thank you so much for the interview.
Thank you so much. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.